cliffcentral.com.
The Leadership Platform is brought to you by Sibanye-Gold, a proudly South African mining company.
At Sibanye-Gold, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. Which is why we have partnered with the Leadership Platform to nurture leaders who are committed to growing our country's economy.
We are proud to say it's an initiative that's already showing glittering results. Sibanye-Gold, we are one.
Yes, go to leadershipplatform.com, two P's in the middle for all things leadership, articles around the guests that we've met and written about, and lots of leadership content there. Jose Dos Santos, CEO of CellC. Welcome to the Leadership Platform. It's great to have you with us.
Adrian, very good afternoon to you, and thanks so much for having me on the show.
I'm excited, and for our listeners now and those who will be listening to the podcast, we met for at least 2 hours last week. He made space. It was probably supposed to be an hour, but we had this fascinating conversation for 2 hours, probably could have continued, just about life, about South Africa, about where the world is going, about leadership, and I hope we can replicate some of that here today. I think we will. So I'm really excited to have you here. Last week, a reminder, there's a podcast for this. We spoke about reputation management with Janine Hills from Vuma Reputation Management. And, of course, she's one of the experts in the industry around this. Fascinating conversation. I think Alice dared ask her what advice she would give President Zuma, for example. So I think we took away a couple of gems from that. But today, I don't know, in my own, I don't know, spontaneous way, just say I will try and explain how I saw CellC some time back. You got the impression over the years that there was a bit of innovation, and then they came with this massive Trevor Noah campaign, and but you always knew that they're just on the verge of trouble all the time, like the stepchild of the cell phone industry. That's years ago. It was like they just couldn't get going, and the burden of debt, and I don't know, it just seemed like a business that was struggling to find its full and rightful place in the industry. Then you came into the picture, originally with Alan Notcraig. We'll talk a bit more about your career in the second half. But when you took over as CEO, what was the status of CellC? I mean, you took over a couple of years ago. Just kind of what was the, where were they sitting? Just give us a feel, because then we're going to look at kind of where it progressed to, this incredible transformation. And we'll look at what has it taken from a big picture point of view to turn around the business. And we'll zoom in on those big picture elements that you mentioned. In terms of a lesson, there's lots of businesses that need turning around these days. Yours wasn't a Mickey Mouse one. It's a big business. And that's the spirit of today's Leadership Master Lesson, is turning around a business. So where was CellC, in essence, when you took over?
Adrian, I think, you know, for the audience, it may be worth sort of 30 seconds understanding why CellC really never took off. Mm. And I think, you know, and people will say, yeah, hindsight is exact science. The fact is that CellC never found its South African roots and culture. So it was always had good leadership, but foreign leadership. Mm. And I think it sort of lost its way in the South African context of what consumers were looking for in terms of a service provider in the telco space. So by the time, you know, we arrived in 2012 into CellC, you know, inside the company, there was a really, really major culture problem. But more importantly than that, at that point in time, the company was in financial ruin. You know, we found ourselves in a situation with great debt and very sort of lack of approach and focus on what they stood for and which customers they were going to attract in what segments and what their value system was. So fortunately, at that time, the existing shareholders, who are still our shareholders at this present time, were kind enough to give the new management team some leeway. And they put substantial amount of money, tens of millions of dollars, back into the company. Okay. To give us, you know, the financial leverage and muscle that we needed to actually get a few things going. But having said that, at that point in time, that was sort of really just the tip of the iceberg. You know, once you get given money, the question is, what do you do with it?
Yeah.
And how do you get this team of people to actually become aligned and do what is necessary? So the bigots, there was no empowerment, there was no transformation of culture. Everybody was negative. It was the sixth or seventh CEO. I couldn't even recall.
Yeah, amazing.
So we had a major fundamental problem just on the cultural issues. You know, people didn't believe in themselves. They thought the company just couldn't get out of there. And the best part of 12 to 18 months was really an internal focus approach. Just to get everybody on board.
Okay, well, I'm going to go there now. So, a little bit more, let me understand. So, can one rightfully wonder why? So, what kept CLC going? Because, I mean, you say huge debt, financial ruin close to it, hardly a culture, leader after leader after leader. Some of them were like consultants who were pulled in to run the business, and mostly foreigners, always foreigners. So, you kind of say, gee whiz, what kept it going? You know, is it just the industry is still ready for another player and it kept them going?
Well, you know, at that time, as again I say, it's easy to comment now when the business is doing so well, but at that time it was just financial muscle. Every time you got into a problem, you know, the shareholders put, you know, more capital investment into the organization. So they would go and spend it. And I mean, we built a great network. It just didn't work. Wow. So the infrastructure was there. You didn't have the technical competence. So you had all the infrastructure, you had the radio base stations up, you had this great core network, but you couldn't make a call for longer than 200 meters before you dropped it. So it was really just getting the alignment, and it kept going because the shareholders believed in it, and they still do. They're still very active, and they just funded the business, and so your debt just grew and grew, and you weren't getting any returns. You know, your customer base was sitting at about 5 million, 6 million back in 2011, 2012, and not generating any revenue. So, you know, anyone who's listening will know if you don't get the revenue, you don't get the margin, you don't
Big
get
problem.
Profit. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, it is very simple, isn't it? So it's now a different business. You know, we'll get to where it is, but we know it's a really feasible business. I guess doing well is a relative term. You'd always want it to do better, but it's doing much better. It's a real player. You get the feeling. It's Maverick. It's taking on the industry. It's got a voice. It seems like we're back in ya. We're fighting this thing. So just, I guess, huge change. I mean, it's taken 4 years or so, I guess, to do it.
Yep, just on 3.5 years to get to where we are. And, you know, outside of the culture, we had to really, you know, show the consumers that we were serious. So in the early stages, there was a lot of criticism about, are we starting a price war? The fact is, you know, people like myself, Alan, and a lot of the other colleagues that came on board at the time knew that, you know, we were charging exorbitant prices for years with the other two incumbents. You know, most of us worked in one of the incumbents or another.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first thing was to get the record straight, both with the regulator, you know, government, and the two incumbents, to say there's a lot of room to actually bring prices down. And as much as there were certain, you know, people in all spectrums of the industry criticizing us and some, you know, applauding us in the sense that we started a price war. No, we just showed that we could actually drop pricing. And subsequently, if you look at telco pricing over the years, it's all come down as a result of what we did. That came at as a huge sacrifice, as you can, you know, probably try and understand. So the company is already in financial trouble, and the little bit of revenue you are generating, you've just given all your margin away.
Yeah, and you've got margin, so why not capitalize on it, then go fight the price war? But you just went for what I guess you believed was right.
Yeah, so we went for that, and it paid dividends. You know, at the end of the day, I always say the customer is right, and we went out there with a value proposition, and we, you know, created a mark for ourselves, and we were rewarded handsomely from the customer's perspective.
What is your subscriber base now?
So we're just short of 23 million.
Crazy, isn't it?
So just also for the listenership, you know, when we say 23 million, we refer to 23 million SIM cards. In customers, you probably could take a factor of 2.5. Because today people have so many SIM cards with so many devices. You've got iPads, you've got devices for your kids and devices for, you know, all different applications that you may want to use. So one consumer, one individual may be paying for 3 or 4 SIM cards. So we measure SIM cards. And I think that key indicator will fall away and people will start looking at revenue share, which is really the best indicator. So we're sitting close on 14%, you know, 13 and a bit percent revenue share, coming from around 7%. You know, sort of 3 years ago.
A huge improvement in growth. All right, so give us the headline macro steps you took to turn around this business. And we'll look, and as I said, the second half a little bit. You and Alan Notcrate came in together. Health-wise, he couldn't stay on much, but you were always there with him running it from the start. Well, look at that. But what are the three, four, five key things that you think you did to turn around the business that could help another CEO with his or her business?
Yeah. Look, I'm a very simple and basic individual in running businesses. And what we did was people. So we had to get rid of, and I use the term lightly, you know, people who didn't believe in the company, who had no faith, no passion, and we had to bring in the expertise into the company. That was the first thing. So the first part of the year was really bringing in a whole new team in terms of the leadership levels that understood what it took to get this right, whether it was network, whether it was commercial, finance, procurement, all those aspects had to be looked at. And then we had to, you know, really try and assist individuals to say, look, this company has got a future, but if you don't believe it doesn't, then you can leave. And that was a tough time for us. I think at the end of the day, we downsized by just close on 500 individuals. Mm-hmm. And it was through a consultative process saying, look, you know, if you don't think the company is going to get it right, then why are you here? And it was a difficult time because when you do these kind of things in restructuring, the staff morale drops. So once we had gotten that done, it is how do you build morale? You know, today when you look and you see our belief campaign, which is sort of, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this is a nice, great brand. It's inspirational. It's lively. It's fun. That campaign was really conceived for the internal staff. It was never meant to go out there and be publicized externally. It was called Believe, and it was launched to the staff to believe in themselves that we could actually get this right, that we could actually build a company with great values and a great performance and actually deliver on our customer promise. But it was so well received that eventually I was convinced to actually make it a campaign for the consumer at large, and it's been well received by the consumer. So today, if you look at SLC, it was really getting the whole alignment. You know, we only have four pillars in our company of strategy. You know, it's quality of network, and you know, we can talk about, you know, where the networks are evolving in the technology going forward. It's about human capital. You know, we've gone from getting the right people, empowering them, motivating them to ownership, and we can talk about how this new recapitalization of SLC, where the staff all become shareholders and they've officially now control the company effectively from 1st
big
of June.
Big step.
And that's part of transformation.
Yeah.
Customer-centric was always the key part, is how do we embrace our customers, and that's an ongoing process, but we've come a long, long way and we're starting to reap the benefits of really looking after our customers. And then the innovation hub. You know, today, 3 years ago, a company was literally bankrupt. Today, we're the first ones to launch Wi-Fi calling. 2 weeks from now, we launch LTE Advanced commercially in two of the provinces of the country. No other network has done that, and they won't be doing that for some time on a commercial basis. So we've gone from really being at the bottom of the barrel in terms of innovation and really having some of the best innovative products in the industry. And it was really working in an environment that's conducive. I mean, Adrian, you've been to SLC's campus, and I think if you go to any of our campuses nationwide, first and foremost, we've got to look after our customer. And once we've done that, let's have some fun. And I think we have a lot of fun, you know, in the company. We drive a hard bargain. You know, when we have to work, we work, and the team know that. But when we have fun, I tell you, I've worked with a lot of teams in my life, and this is a team that really has stepped up. To making a difference in society, to making a difference in this company. And it's been a hard road to get everyone aligned. And, you know, it's people always say, oh, but you're tough. You have to be tough if you're turning business around. You know, you say, but you sometimes autocratic. Well, somebody has to make those tough decisions, and that's leadership.
Partly, you've kind of given the business back to South Africans. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Louis, comments on the overall pillars and steps that Jose and his team have taken. Some simple things there, but I like simplicity and powerful.
What I love about it, to say, is all the experience we've had in this field is about obviously situational confidence. We feel we can do it. That's attitude and that's human capital. And secondly, is about defining the essences of what we do. And then it becomes far more simple. Because a better example of our government now has many essences, many. It's got no sense, you know. There's no priority, really, etc. I think the ability you people show of doing that is pretty exciting. You know your essences, and you certainly show a spirit of situational confidence, which, of course, is all about confidence ultimately. But you had to build it. And everybody wants to change the organization around. Please, it needs to be built. It's work.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to touch with you, base with you. But the Innovation Hub, tell us a little bit about that. What exactly is that, and how does it play a key role? You've got all the creatives in there and the people thinking. What is it about?
Well, in terms of innovation, say in the context of our industry, is really looking at what consumers want today and how do we package our products differently. But also importantly, what do they want tomorrow and the next year and years to come. So we have, in most cases, a sort of 12, 18-month sort of section of the Innovation Hub. And then we have sort of the more medium to long-term. Wi-Fi calling was almost 2 years in the making. That's how complex it was to build systems and bring those platforms in and integrate them into our network. So that,
tell us quickly, Wi-Fi calling in essence.
Well, so basically today Celsius has the widest coverage anywhere, you know, as an operator. In other words, if you have a Wi-Fi calling enabled handset, you get into a situation where there is no coverage, a network coverage, and you have Wi-Fi, you can make a call at exactly the same price as you'd normally pay. The important thing about that is if you go out into a lodge where they just have a Wi-Fi facility, they don't have any communications, you're still in contact. It's a perfect, clear, crystal clear call. But importantly is if you roam now, anywhere in the world, any country in the world, if you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, you can make calls to any fixed line network, any mobile line network, at the same price as you'd be charged for making a call in South Africa. So no more exorbitant roaming fees, no more saying, well, my network doesn't roam in this country and doesn't have a facility. So if you see our latest, you know, payoff line and slogan is, you know, we have the widest coverage, and that's the essence of it. You now can make a call on any Wi-Fi hotspot. And that was complex. That was over, just to put it in perspective, we spent close on 100 million rand putting that platform to work. So you arrive in any country in the world, you go into a Wi-Fi hotspot, and you can make calls to anyone you like. It's not an application base, so people don't need an app to make it. You just, you know, use it as a normal phone. And all these latest handsets are coming out with Wi-Fi calling enablement. It's a thing of the future, so... You know, it's a great tool to have now.
I mean, Wi-Fi is more important than what's on your menu. I mean, it's like everything, isn't it?
Exactly.
You know, so you've got that, and you say the others will have to follow eventually, but not tomorrow.
Well, you know, these are complex developments that take place. So, you know, and I know that our competitors have been trying hard to, you know, launch Wi-Fi calling, and they haven't been that successful in making it actually work. You know, it takes a lot of time to get these platforms integrated. They are complex technologies nowadays.
Mm.
But, yeah, as I said, that was a two-year approach. On a short-term approach, it's consistent being innovative in terms of what customers want. You know, I was saying to my staff just two months ago, today people are not really interested in the SIM card that they have from which operator. They're more in tune of what application they use. In other words, your brand affiliation to an application is greater than it is to your network. A classic example is if I started deleting Facebook from your phone and WhatsApp and Skype, at some point in time, you're going to get very, very annoyed with me. But if I took your SIM card out and I put another SIM card, provided you had relatively good connectivity at an affordable price, I don't think you'd get too upset.
No.
So our innovation is, what are customers looking for in terms of content? What applications do they use? You've seen we've been very aggressive with OTT players. We embrace them, the likes of Facebook, the likes of WhatsApp. You know, we play a major role in ensuring that customers, you know, in the ecosystem have this kind of loyalty and attraction to the offerings that we put out there.
Okay. You believe in a 1,000-day principle, which is not rocket science, but I kind of like that. Just that, what's that philosophy you have?
Well, I think most people get stale after 1,000 days, and I include myself. So either you have a life-changing trigger after 1,000 days or you step down. So if you actually look at my track record, in most cases I sort of did it for 1,000 days. And unless we had a major event that would make me stay on, you know, because the company was about to change, then it's time to step down. And that's sort of the principle I have. Every 1,000 days you either step down or you totally reinvent yourself.
Mm.
And this is what's happened at CLC. You know, I've done my 1,000 days. And had we not gone into this recapitalization where we've gone through a transformation of ownership, empowering people, to now saying you're going to own 25% of the share capital, so the staff will now own 25% of the share capital in the company, and that's going to take me another 2-3 years to make sure that we have a great founding sort of implementing the company. The chances are I'd have left because, mm-hmm. you know, you need new blood. You need new people to come in with new ideas. And this is, you know, we in each industry, and I say this, with respect to a lot of other industries. There's industries out there, financial institutions, mining, that you can have a CEO there for 20 years.
Yeah.
And it makes absolutely no material difference. That was fine maybe 10 years ago. Now with the crisis in the world and the commodity prices being what they are, you need CEOs to come into that space that will say, well, what do we do now? It's a different world. And it becomes very complex. So I've always been in dynamic industries of telco. And I think after 1,000 days, you either reinvent yourself or you walk away.
And it's a dynamic industry, but still you feel it's not like you can be a CEO here forever because it's such a dynamic, progressive industry. Still within your boundaries of your business, you've got to redefine it. And one of the things you're doing dramatically, especially for Cell C, is the ownership structure. What difference does that make? I mean, you're now tasting it. As you're moving towards finality in that, it's not final yet where staff will be owners. What's the attitudinal shift that you're picking up in the business?
It was very interesting. I mean, again, just by way of background, 7-8 months ago, there were other large organizations who were thinking of buying us out.
Correct, yeah.
And that would have brought it a whole different dynamics of integration. We were fortunate enough that when I went and saw the principal shareholder, I gave them a plan, which was for management ownership to take place. And that was quite a complex discussion because that means that the existing shareholders would have to dilute. So you can imagine we were 75% by our parent shareholder plus BE of 25. And the proposal was, look, you're going to go down to 30. We're going to go and sell another 30% of shares to another company, which in this case was Blue Label Telecoms. 15% we're going to give to a very strategic partner. And unfortunately, I can't talk too much about that. And then the remaining 25%, you're going to give it to all the staff. And we're going to control the company. We're going to sit down at board meetings and we'll have the final vote. That was a tough, tough discussion. And, you know, we got great shareholders. And eventually they said, Jose, I believe in your vision that, you know, management should have control of the company with its staff. And when I came back and started the roadshow and said, look, we're out of the market. No one's going to buy it. We're actually buying this company ourselves. And this is how we're going to, you know, put it to play. 7 months later, and almost at the execution process, what we're seeing is an amazing transformation of ownership. You know, I no longer have to worry about whether people are buying too much water, wasting too much, you know, food, all the simple things that most companies think, well, it's just there, but it makes a huge cost and a huge difference. I walk into meetings by surprise now. You know, we have all these, you know, meeting rooms and people say, oh, they're having a meeting there about network or commercial. And I'll just pop in and I sit down and I listen. And this is what I hear, which I didn't hear three months ago. I beg your pardon, 3 years ago, where we just need to spend this money. Where's the budget? Where's the budget? We're spending this money. Now what I say is, look, we're going to spend this. Where's the plan? And how much are we going to get as a return? And I hear people saying, but we really need to spend this money. I mean, I had a simple, simple issue just that I bumped into by accident last week. One of the regions wanted to buy a new fridge. And the guy says, but you've already got a fridge. He says, but we need a new one. He says, but the old one's still working. So that was the end of that. And this is not being done at senior level now. This is middle and lower management that's taking those decisions. They say, listen, I'm a shareholder. It's quite nice to you down the corridors and you've got sort of the average employee in the company. Say, but hold on, 1st of June, I'm also a shareholder. So I can also be vocal and question you on how you're spending the money. So it's really early days, but it's so inspiring for me, you know, to see these young people and management questioning themselves and questioning their colleagues and saying, if we're going to spend money, how much return do we get? If we're not doing this, how better do we do it? I mean, just to give an example, our senior leadership team now, once a month, sits in the call center for an hour and listens to customers. You know, I remember once the customer, the lady who headed up customer care came to me and said, we need to spend money to upgrade our systems. And the IT chief turned around and says, no, I don't think you do. And I said, well, how would you know? You've never listened to a customer. So I said, go and listen to the customers, see how the call center agents are operating, and then tell me if they need to upgrade. And she came back later and says, you're right, we need to upgrade these systems. It will make the call center agents' life so much easier, and we'll be able to service customers so much better. So now it goes without saying, once a month, every senior executive goes to the call center, sits there for an hour, listens to the customers, and the decisions that are being taken are more precise decisions, more involved, more ownership, and things just seem to work. Because everybody's involved.
It's like a mining giant whose executive goes down to the face, there where the drilling happens, there where they actually get the stuff, as they say. And that's the essence of the business. I mean, wherever you touch the customer, If you lose contact with that. Yeah. So, I mean, you're seeing more and more empowerment all the way down, decisions being made at the right levels, not junior managers or supervisors waiting for decisions at the top. So all of that kicking in, and that creates a more empowered business.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's about to happen, and this is only two or three executives are aware of this, so, you know, I'm happy to discuss it on air. You know, we have a massive distribution network, which is, you know, it's a franchise network.
Mm.
And I called the franchisees into the office about a week ago. And I said, look, in general, I'm happy on the way you service customers, but I'm also not that happy because you put the brand in disrepute. So we have to up the levels. And, you know, the guys were listening and saying, but what do we do? I said, let me tell you what I'm going to do. If you don't perform, I'm going to cancel your franchisee. And now what I'm doing is I'm looking at staff, these entrepreneur staff that we have in the company, and I'm going to say, here's a store for you. So now the franchisees are saying, what, you're going to fire us? You're going to terminate our agreement? I said, absolutely. If you fail on one of the net promoter scores and you don't perform to the level I want you, you're out. And a lot of people came to me and said, but where's your plan B? I said, I've been working on plan B for 3 years. I said, it's part of my transformation process. I'm going to take the real youngsters, you know, the kids that are in this company that are angry, that are as dynamic as I was 40, 50 years ago, that will do anything to be successful. I'm going to take them. I'm going to give them a brand new store. And says, but they don't have the money. I said, we'll fund it. Mm. And we'll have loyalty for life. I said, and that's what we're trying to do. And so the three or four executives who've been involved, they said, Jesus, you know, Jose, this is amazing. Why didn't we think about it? I said, but this is it. This is what we're trying to do. This is what trying to build. Now, if you wake up 3, 4, 5 years from now and you have a balance of 50% of your stores are owned by independent franchisees and 50% of your stores are owned by your own staff, that you've made wealthy in their own right, that they have a sense of ownership. They say, yes, my little business, I own 2 or 3 stores. You know, this is what it's about. And this is really just something that we've been working and hard to achieving. So, yeah.
So, Louis, we're looking at empowerment here, aren't we, on many levels. And we're at the end of this half. We're looking in the next half a little bit more about some of these issues, in fact. And Richard Angus might join us as well, involved in the platform. Any final comments on turning around the business, the principles that were highlighted?
Arden, you know, we use years of research. We call it the law of movement. All movement is governed by the integration of motivation, direction, and structure. We find in practice, if there's a lack of motivation, then you want to throw more structure, more money, more budget, etc. And what you've done, you've really invested. Mm. It just confirms, just say, our investment in leadership. It's all about leadership. The more you focus on the human capital side and really let them reflect your passion, the more suddenly they become frugal and they find answers innovative instead of looking for money to answer it. There's a balance, of course. So I love that.
But you say, before we move on to the next section, it's so simple. We're sitting here and you share it. I know it's difficult, but it's simple. Why do a lot of leaders not see it? What stops them from sensing this essence and the simplicity of raising motivation by putting ownership back to employees in practical and in not so practical ways? Is it an ego thing? What do you think stops another CEO from doing these things?
Look, I'm not going to get involved in whether it's egos or not. I think there's a lot to play. But let me tell you what the telco sector has helped me in my leadership. Because, you know, of the social media and the interactivity that customers have now, and we the conduit to connecting customers to all the social media, I had to learn very quickly on the impact of how consumers think and how they feel. And if we're not listening to them, then the chances are we as leaders make the wrong decisions. If I look at some of the senior leaderships in this country of other industries, and I talk to them because, you know, we're the friends or we know them and we do business together, and I said, do you guys go and talk to your customers? Do you, if I email you, do you reply yourself? So if I get an email from a client that sends me an email to my personal email address, I reply personally. I say to my assistant, and she used to take them and handle them herself. She used to take it out of my inbox. And I say, you don't do that. I want to reply to this individual, be it him or her, myself. And so I find other leadership players, they don't do that. They say, no, I've got a whole team of people who attend to this. I said, so how do you know what's happening in your business? He says, well, I get a report every month.
Oh, no, ouch. Yeah.
Exactly. The only report I generate is for my board pack when I sit every 3 months with my shareholders, which I think they need to have, pack. I don't have any reports coming to me. I pick up the phone. I phone my executive team. They phone me. And we're in tune. And I think this industry is, because we all had to change and we've adapted. And other leaders, I think they tend to sit in their hierarchy structure and they'd be surprised if they got deep down into their businesses and understood what's going on. I think they'd really change and they'd actually see far better growth than they've seen before.
Arjun, this is the principle. Remember, one top CEO told us he learned from the Coca-Cola CEO overseas about line of sight. Always have a line of sight.
Yeah.
In your case, in this game, you have to be in contact with the customer. That's line of
sight.
And also, I remember having Bernard Swanepoel here, former the guy who pretty much built Harmony Gold, and said, what's the one lesson you've learned? And he said, and what would you do differently if you went back? I think I asked him, and he said, I'd listen more. I'd listen on all structures, and I'd really find ways to listen more. And that's what I also hear you saying. Well, that's Jose Dos Santos, CEO of Cell C, a company to be reckoned with these days after a couple of years of hard work. And the last half hour, we've looked at some pointers, some simple things that they've done to turn the business around. Of course, there's more detail, but that was fascinating. So next up, stay with us. We're going to discuss a little bit more with Jose, but his career, where does he come from, his philosophies. And he believes in women empowerment. Why? Maybe an overview of the industry. That would be very interesting as well. And you met, I think he met, is it the Facebook founder? Yeah, Mark
Zuckerberg.
Zuckerberg, that's right. Just tell us a little bit about that afterwards. So lots coming up. Stay with us.
CliffCentral.com.